Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Schneider of IndieWire and Variety, filling in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
My feeling is good ideas can be pretty cheap if you have them early enough. So some of the things that people really loved about our show were things that we talked about in the first 2 hours of our first meeting.
When director Thomas Kail took a break from Broadway's Hamilton to take on the TV musical Grease Live on Fox, he had a very specific vision for the complicated production, and his plan worked. Grease Live was a hit, and Kail's revival raised the bar on TV musicals. We talked to the Tony-winning director, who now has an Emmy nomination as well. Then, another Emmy nominee, actor Sterling K. Brown, tells us how he prepared to play prosecutor Chris Darden in the FX limited series The People vs. O.J. Simpson. But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, the fight for Viacom is over, and Philippe Dumont is on the way out and with a hefty parachute. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Mike.
So the long feud between the 93-year-old mogul Sumner Redstone and now former or about to be former Viacom CEO Philippe Dumont appears to be over. So Viacom's board has met and they're finalizing a settlement between both parties before they're forced to go to trial, which saves them from having to air lots of dirty laundry, especially around Sumner Redstone's health and mental competency. Matt, what do you make of this?
Well, it seems to be a win for both sides. I mean, this has been something that Sherry Redstone, Sumner's daughter and a very important figure in the Viacom National Amusements drama, has wanted for a long time. She's wanted Philippe Dumont out. And from our sources, it's indicated that he's going to get about $72 million up front. There are some incentives as well that could even bring that number higher than that. That's a pretty decent payout for someone who, by all accounts, has been a drag on the company for at least a year now as this drama has played out.
Yeah, and it should be noted that although this drama now seems to be coming to a conclusion, Viacom itself is still very much a beleaguered media company. MTV, Comedy Central, Nickelodeon, all properties that have seen ratings declines, revenue declines over the past couple years, they're all really flailing right now. And also Paramount Pictures is in a precarious position.
Yeah, and the question is, you know, has the distraction in the boardroom negatively impacted the businesses of the company? And I think the argument could be made that yes. I mean, you talk to people at Paramount, they feel like this has been just a cloud over the studio. They have not been able to invest in things like they want to. They haven't been able to go after the top projects. This whole notion of whether the studio stake is going to be sold to a Chinese company, this has all been a very depleting influence on the company. And now the question is, moving forward, what comes next?
Yeah, and one question that we've all had over and over again, you know, CBS and Viacom split in 2006. Now, Leslie Moonves, the head of CBS, has said he's not interested in running both companies or bringing them back together. But is there still a chance that eventually these two sides are remerged?
Yeah, I mean, I think the prevailing wisdom on this is that most people believe Leslie Moonves is the preferred choice to ultimately run both these companies, either in a merged capacity or as separate companies, but with the same chief executive, as was the case at the Fox empire when News Corp and Fox were split and Rupert Murdoch was running both. There is going to be an interim CEO, Tom Dooley, who was the COO and is sort of seen as the, you know, business as usual type person. I don't see him being there for very long. But the question is the Moonves factor. Is he going to run both companies? And if not, what are they going to do with the other side, with the Viacom side?
Well, we'll keep our eyes on that. Meanwhile, in the film world, there's unfortunate situation that has reemerged regarding Nate Parker, who, of course, is the director and star of The Birth of a Nation, which was a Sundance darling. It actually sold for a record $17.5 million to Fox Searchlight, part of a big Oscar campaign. But Matt, the news that's resurfacing about Nate Parker threatens to derail the entire project.
Yeah, I mean, this story is just so tragic on many levels. This alleged rape that occurred in 1999, Parker was ultimately acquitted of the charges. But in the ramp up to the release of this movie, he's starting to do some press for it. And that's where we're seeing not only him speaking about it, but in addition to what happened to this woman, she ultimately died by suicide 4 years ago at age 30. And just everything around this is so awful that it even feels difficult to talk about the impact on a movie. But the fact of the matter is Searchlight paid a lot of money for this movie, and they now have to figure out how to release this and how to craft an Oscar campaign that will position this film for awards and ultimately an audience.
Yeah, and further complicating things as a part of the sale, of course, is that Parker was going to be front and center on a roadshow as the film came out in wide release, speaking at colleges and Christian groups. And as the face of the movie now, that brings up a lot of questions. And how much does Fox Searchlight want Nate Parker to continue to be the face of this movie? And how do they get around that, considering no matter what, he is the face of this movie?
Yeah, I know that that's the question being debated internally at Searchlight right now. They do plan to go ahead with the film's big screening at the Toronto Film Festival. Parker does plan to be there. It'll be interesting to see if he takes questions on stage after the film, what they do with him, what kind of media they allow him to do. From everything I've heard, he wants to address this head on and go ahead with the planned rollout as everything was scheduled before this came out. But I think right now Searchlight is probably going to pull him back a little bit and, you know, do some press, but maybe not put him in on college campuses in front of potentially hostile audiences. And I could see him being a more limited presence during the awards season where they really try to make the film speak for itself.
Yeah, and this also, of course, complicates the Film Academy's attempts to diversify the Oscars in light of Oscars So White last year.
Yeah, this film, which is about a slave uprising, was seen as a very strong contender to end the Oscars So White. There are other films this year, but it's a very interesting question as to whether this film will get traction ultimately.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, the executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. That's Jessie J performing Grease is the Word as she winds her way through high school sets, backstage hallways, dressing rooms, and even outdoors in the long single shot that opens Grease Live. The show premiered live on Fox in January of this year. It's the most recent production in a spate of musical revivals embraced by broadcast networks in search of the high ratings that come with live events. More than 12 million people tuned in to watch Rydell High's Sandy and Danny, played by Julianne Hough and Aaron Tveit, reminisce on those summer nights, be born a hand jive, and of course, experience an electrifying carnival connection.
Sandy?
Tell me about it. Stir.
Grease Live is a technically complex production that's constantly in motion. Cameras follow a large cast over multiple locations in front of a live audience who are actually sitting on set. The show received 10 Emmy nominations, including one for our guest today, director Thomas Kail. Kail is also the Tony-winning director of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway juggernaut, Hamilton. And before that, he directed Miranda's first Broadway musical, In the Heights. When Kail recently talked to our host of the business, Kim Masters, he recalled the first time he encountered Miranda in college.
I was doing a show at Wesleyan in the student-run theater, and my show had seven lights. And at that juncture, there were probably seven lights on campus for all the shows to use. And I heard that someone else was borrowing our equipment when we weren't using it, and it was some musical being done in a dorm written by this very precocious freshman, last name Miranda, first name Lynn. And so I heard about him as someone who was pilfering the things that I needed. And so I don't think the first thing I said about him was that gracious, because he was stealing from us in my mind.
Mm. And then you somehow, I'm not quite sure how you connected later.
Lynn wrote an early version of In the Heights his sophomore year in the 2000. And I had graduated at that point, and I was driving a van and working as an assistant stage manager at this theater called the American Stage Company in Teaneck, New Jersey. Some of my buddies who were still in school saw this early version of Heights and sent it to me and said, we should produce this when Lynn graduates in 2 years. And I agreed with them. And so I really connected with him in May of 2002 when we went back up to watch his senior project and then invite him to join us.
I just have to say, wow, that's amazing that it turned out to be, you know, it sounds like, yeah, let's do this. And then it turned, I don't know if you had a sense that, of any sense that this was going to be what it became.
It was the furthest thing from my mind that it would blossom into the friendship that it has or the creative partnership that it's become.
So the interesting thing in context of Grease, which congratulations on, by the way.
Thank you.
You were signed to do Grease before Hamilton opened.
That is correct.
How did that happen?
The people at Fox have really good taste.
but Paramount started cobbling it together,
Paramount,
right?
Paramount came to me probably, I think the first time we had a conversation about it was the summer of 2014. I got a phone call from my agent and he said, is this something you'd be interested in? And it was indeed. I grew up in the middle of two sisters and we own three movies. It's a Wonderful Life, Grease, and Grease 2. So it was the first musical that I really experienced. I didn't grow up going to a lot of theater. I went to theater every now and then.
You were a sports kid, I read.
I was a sports kid, yeah. So, you know, I thought, well, here's a chance for me to throw my hat in the ring, being someone who's interested in making theater for everybody and is ultimately a populace. And you know, the reality is with a show like Grease, I thought, I haven't really done a revival. Here's an opportunity to do something that I love, that the world loves and has admiration for in this form that I'm fascinated by. So when NBC started making their shows with lots of my friends going and trying to do this very difficult thing, I thought, well, it's easy to sit on the couch and say, this is how I would do it. And I said, so go and do it.
I just don't know how you did the logistics of this really complicated, you know, the camera moves and costume changes. A live audience, which NBC has not done. How much of the NBC stuff, you know, they've done a few now, had you seen before you even undertook this?
I'd seen all three, and I watched them and cheered on my friends. I knew people working on all of those. So, you know, this is quite a difficult undertaking, doing these kinds of things. And so we feel like we're part of this larger fabric, and we exist, and the opportunity exists because of the success of those other shows. So my feeling was surround yourself with people that have the same passion that you do, have skills that you don't have, and see if you can unify and identify the best idea. So the folks at Paramount really sort of started to surround me and equip me with people that could access information that I didn't have and had skills that were really necessary. Mark Platt, our producer, introduced me to Zach Woodley, our choreographer. I got introduced through Fox and Paramount to Alex Rosinski, who is the live television director. You know, like this was a chance to kind of put a bunch of smart people on a, you know, on a little Grease party wagon and see how far we could drive it.
Did you go back and forth commuting?
I did. I was commuting for quite a few months. And then I went out Thanksgiving of last year and I was out there for about 10 straight weeks.
And it felt like Hamilton was established enough that you could say, yeah, somebody else take this for a while. I'm going to go do that.
Well, the nature of being a director of a show that is going to run and has months and maybe years after it is that my job is to build the show so that it can exist without me. And if I've made something that needs me to be there every day, I failed. And I feel that very deeply, even though I'm never, I mean, it is hours of my day every single day. And if I'm in town, I'm there a couple, three times a week. I'm presently in rehearsal for the Chicago company, which, you know, I've cast and I'm now making the show with a completely new group of people. So that's sort of what the process of that is. Make something that can exist without you. And it's an ethos that I follow and really believe in.
So did you say to yourself when you were watching The Sound of Music, Peter Pan, The Wiz, we've got to have a live audience. We've got to go outdoors and risk that it might not be great weather, even though it's Los Angeles. You should be able to count on great weather, but not necessarily in January.
Did I think it was going to rain that day? my power is quite limited, and I'm not going to claim any credit for that. But, you know, we were in L.A. for 60 days, and it rained twice. The first day we were on the stages visiting on December 22nd, and then the day of the show. And it was raining sideways that morning. It was a 100% chance of rain. And it also, I think, reminded the whole world at once, oh, right, this is happening. And it really liberated our cast. I think it became this incredible kickoff to the show was really heightened by that. So the way the company performed that day, it was like this remarkable relay race. And the nature of the show with the 12 acts created so artfully by our writers, John Tolins and Rob Carey, we tried to put one real element of theatrical magic in every act. But we also had to execute all of the other things around it. And this cast just, they never looked down. That's the only way I can describe it. If they were up high, they never looked down until 7:01 when everyone was standing in front of Rydell High after the curtain call, And I just watched 100 people start crying. It was like immediately it was over. And it was like this release. It was really intense and rather beautiful.
So when you were presenting it, was the budget or did you say, I need this? And they were like, oh, God, please don't say that.
You know, I made sure that there was a golf cart budget because that was obviously important. But I mean, I'm a practical person and I've produced and I'm a producer. So I'm very aware of how much things cost. Right. And I also know how to... I know how to ask for stuff. I know what really matters, and I know what to go to the mat for. And there's things that you can cut loose. In every conversation you have, the question is, can I make compromise and not be compromised? And that's something that I think about a lot. And I had a lot of people around the production that were just trying to support the vision. And because the vision was clear and the vision made sense to everybody and was articulated with clarity throughout, I think that, you know, then it's not about money. It's just about doing the thing. Now, there is a budget and there is a time when there is no more money to spend. But up until then, you just try to be really practical about those things. And my feeling is good ideas can be pretty cheap if you have them early enough. So some of the things that people really loved about our show were things that we talked about in the first 2 hours of our first meeting. I knew I wanted to do a curtain call. We knew we wanted to embrace a live audience. We wanted to have a long shot to establish using that first song as the opening. Once we realized we were going to be in multiple places, then the idea of showing the travel in between the places became a possibility. So then we put a couple GoPros on go-karts, and all of a sudden then you're on the cart with people.
So give us a picture. You're doing the thing. Are you on a go-kart? I mean, are you running from place to place? What are you doing?
Well, you know, when I first started rehearsing with the company, we were still in the rehearsal space in December. I asked them, I said, where do you think I could be the most useful? Because, you know, the reality is, although like sometimes in like bad Hollywood movies, the director's like lingering backstage a lot during opening night. And I'm not quite sure where they got that idea, but that seems like the director should let it go and watch the show. But I said, I'll be wherever I can be the most useful. And so I thought maybe I'll get my Lorne Michaels on and I'll be sort of like wandering around, you know, just like looking at things, like whispering something that's like exactly the right thing to say. Mm. And then the more we started rehearsing, I was like, I think I need to be in the truck. So I watched sitting behind Alex Wazinski and his team. I was sitting right next to Mark Platt and we were watching on monitors in a truck. And this was what was so sort of out of body. There'd be a commercial break and we'd walk outside and it would be the calmest, quietest thing, you know, just like maybe like you'd see like someone like in a Letterman sweater sprint through. And then you go back inside and there's a dance at the gym. So, you know, it was this kind of release. I think every commercial break we walked outside and got a little fresh air and kind of looked at each other and said, I think it's going okay. And then we like went back in.
Amazing. So you're you. You've done In the Heights, Hamilton, this. I mean, you've done all of that. And what is it that you want to do? I guess you can write your ticket. You just made a deal at Fox to do something.
Yes. I was like, something sounds good. Well, you know, after I did Grease, I came back to New York and I did two plays back to back. And I loved the opportunity to go in and just start at zero again and make something. And when you're making a play, there really is an arc to that. It's going to start and it's going to end. And maybe it'll extend a little bit, but it's not this thing that will just run and run and run, even if it goes fantastically well. Theater is about saying hello and saying goodbye. And that's why I like kind of parachuting in and thinking, okay, these are the skills I have. Here are the people that I've assembled. What can we make? And the prospect of being able to do that with Fox and make television for them, the open field that I see is actually probably the closest I felt to, you know, probably when I was in my early 20s, running my little theater company in the basement of the Drama Bookshop, where I had a space and I could invite my friends to inhabit that space. And I took great joy and satisfaction in producing. And I think that there's an opportunity to do that with some of the things that I've been thinking about with television and a lot of talented people that I know that haven't made TV yet that I think have something to say. And I want to try to enable that as best I can.
Thomas Kail, director of Hamilton on Broadway and Grease Live on Fox. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up after a short break, actor Sterling K. Brown tells us why he was eager to take on the role of Christopher Darden in The People vs. O.J. Simpson, even though other, more famous actors had turned it down. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Change, 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 change,
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Michael Schneider, filling in for Kim Masters. The FX limited series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story, swept up a whopping 22 Emmy nominations this year, including 6 in the acting categories. One of those nods is for Sterling K. Brown, who is up for Best Supporting Actor for his role as Christopher Darden, a prosecutor placed in an impossible situation. In real life, Darden is the one who asked O.J. Simpson to try on the infamous glove, and its failure to fit is remembered as the nail in the coffin for the prosecution. In the FX series, Darden, as portrayed by Brown, is eager to make a dramatic move that will prove without a doubt Simpson is guilty. Prosecutor Marcia Clark, played by Sarah Paulson, doesn't see the point.
The idea of OJ just standing there in front of those cameras and the jury wearing those gloves.
Guys, come on.
We have his gloves with all the DNA, everybody's blood, the fibers, all of it.
But when the moment arrives, Darden, unable to heed his partner's advice, can't help himself.
At this time, the people would ask that Mr. Simpson step forward and try on the gloves recovered from Bundy and Rockingham.
Brown first started acting in plays in high school, but once he went to college, his life almost went in a different direction. Kim Masters asked him about the life that might have been.
So you come out of high school,
yeah.
You've been acting, but your ambition going into college is to run competing, you want to compete with yourself in fast food.
Where'd you get that from?
I read so many things I can't remember.
Are you kidding me?
I think I read it in a Stanford.
Oh my God. I think that was part of my college essay. So I was an economics major.
I did not hack your college
essay. No, it's all good. I was an economics major, and I had an internship at the Federal Reserve Bank. And one of the reasons why Stanford was so attractive to me is because at the time, they had the number one econ program in the country. And when I got to school, I was sort of bored with it. I did well with it, but anytime I was doing a play, my grades and everything else got better because I was doing something that fed my soul. So it took me a couple of years to recognize that the hobby was actually the calling and that I just needed to release and let go into that.
And then I read that you're embarrassing your girlfriend by pretending you have facial paralysis on the subway.
Where did you get all of this? This is crazy. You're freaking me out. Okay, so when you go into drama 101 classes,
yes,
they'll ask you to do all sorts of particular things. I remember one class where I was asked, we did this thing about sounding, where you put your lips on another person's body and you sort of hum into them.
You hum into
them. Yeah, like vibrations. But it was weird for sure. And so it's interesting that I started from there and now I don't shy away from the weird at all.
You went to the weird.
I went to the weird. And I do things in public that oftentimes my girlfriend, who is now my
wife,
will be
right,
like, what is wrong with you, Brown? Like, why do you do this? I'll start talking with random accents and try to see, like, if I can pass them off as legit. And if people treat me as such, I was like, okay, got that one done.
You unleashed the beast is what
happened. Unleashed the beast.
Yeah.
The Kraken, if you will.
The Kraken emerged very well. And so now, you know, for a long time, you're a working actor. You know, off of Army Wives, which is a role you had for a while,
sure,
you got recognized on the street. Which one do you get recognized for more, OJ? Or because I feel like OJ is so buzzy in a certain demographic, but
absolutely,
I don't know how that compares against a show like Army Wife.
They're both pretty high, but I'll tell you the one where the fans are most rabid. I had an arc on Supernatural from like season 2, and it's now like on season 97. But Supernatural fans will come up to me all the time. That one has probably been the most interesting because only 4 episodes, but the fans are
so rabid
that they devour it. Between Army Wives and OJ, probably still Army Wives, depending on where I am. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. So when I'm in the Midwest, Army Wives reigns supreme. In the South, etc. But out here in Los Angeles and in New York, a lot of buzz for People versus O.J.
Now, looking at you here in the room, right. I would not recognize you as having played Chris Darden.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You got the call to audition for this part and went into the bathroom and cut off your hair.
All of it. Yeah. You know, I've had so many instances in the past where producers have been like, oh, we thought he was great for the part, but he was a little too tall. Or we were wondering what the facial hair would look like. And so from my perspective, let's give them as little to think about as possible and let them see what they need to see. So I cut off my hair, I got my rehearsal glasses, and I wanted to look as much like the part so when I stepped in the room, they didn't have to do any imagining. That was the thought plan behind that whole thing.
I know that if at one point they were looking for a name, and you're up against all of these names.
Yes.
Who are you're like pretty much the standout, not household name
right.
at that time. And so here is this role of Chris Darden, who is in the most excruciating position possibly of anyone other than the Browns and the
Goldmans.
Is there any part of you, did you talk to your wife? Did you say, you know, this guy took it on the chin from the Black community, and I don't know.
It's interesting. I heard through the grapevine that they had reached out to some names.
Right.
And that the names had turned it down because of the unfavorability of the character in the African-American community. And so, you know, there's a trickle-down sort of effect that, you know, certain people pass on it, then they were open to finding someone new. And I'll take it. I was very happy to step in those shoes because you can't play someone and judge them at the same time. And I most definitely had my own judgments about him from 22 years ago and was thankful to have the opportunity to release those judgments and to see things from a completely different perspective. I've had a couple of friends from Stanford in particular that would come up to me and said, you changed the way that I thought about Darden. That's high praise.
Now, I know he declined. You reached out to him and he didn't respond.
Correct.
Nothing to this day?
Nothing to this day. Only correspondence I've had is with his daughter, Janae, who's corresponded with me via Twitter and on Facebook and has been very complimentary, but nothing from her pops.
It's such an excruciating moment when he just goes off and says, try on the glove,
oh,
and you just, no, and, oh,
yeah.
God.
The interesting thing about the glove, as an actor, you're always taught you can't play the end of the scene.
Right.
And so for me to convince myself that this is going to be it, like people are going to stand up and cheer, they're going to see this glove slip onto his hand effortlessly, and then we got it, slam dunk. I really felt it. And so when Cuba gets up and he starts trying on the glove and he's doing, going through all these machinations about how it doesn't, like there was no separation between actor and character. I was just pissed off. I was like, man, you better put these damn gloves on right now because you know your hands ain't that big. And so it was not difficult to play because there was true disgust at the moment.
And now when you were shooting it, did you guys know this was going to be such a thing?
When we would read the scripts, people had genuine enthusiasm. And even though it was a story that everybody knew was going to end, like the way in which they were able to build suspense into it, like wondering what was going to happen next when you know he's going to get acquitted, I got to give all the credit to the producers and the writers for drumming up that kind of drama. I felt like it was good. Do you always know that the public's going to see that or that the critics may receive it as lovingly as you feel in that moment? No, you have no idea. So when it finally did hit and people expressed the enthusiasm that they had, it was like I felt like it was a possibility. I'm happy to see it come into fruition.
So what does this do to a career for you? You were working, things were going well?
Yeah, I think right now the biggest difference that I'm experiencing is, okay, before you go out to audition for a guest spot on a TV show and you sort of hope that, you know, maybe they'll make this character into recurring or that the producers start another show and they'll like your work, etc. I feel like now people are looking to me as like, what would you like to do next? Which is a very cool position to be in, a very humbling position to be in because you work so hard just to get the scraps off the bone. And now it's like people are throwing pieces of steak and saying, does this look good? Or chicken or salmon sometimes.
Right.
So it's nice to feel like there are options that are being made available that haven't been made available to this particular point in time.
Sterling K. Brown, one of the stars of The People versus O.J. Simpson and the upcoming NBC show This Is Us. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Kim. Appreciate it.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you next week on The Business.